Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, if you've listened to us over any length of time, you've probably figured out that a common theme of American Variety is people who have an unusual dream and act on it and succeed at it. I mean, we've had treasure hunters, long-distance solo sailors. I mean, there was a fellow once who literally sailed one-handed across the Atlantic. He was missing one arm, and he sailed a small sloop across the Atlantic with one arm and braved a couple of gale storms and so on. But, you know, explorers, inventors, entrepreneurs, people who've built businesses, you know, very thriving, successful businesses out of their garage or less, out of their car, you know, that kind of thing. And so this week is something similar but different, too. It's an unusual story. It's a married couple who bought a rugged island off the coast of Maine in 1949 and lived there for the next 40 years, basically. And so it's kind of a Henry David Thoreau on Walden Pond kind of story. And my guest today has written a book about their life together in this isolated place. His name is Peter Blanchard III. He's a member of an old-line Eastern establishment family based in New York and New Jersey. Peter's active in several environmental conservation societies and holds a degree, among others, in forestry science from Yale University's School of Forestry and Environmental Sciences. So he has a lifelong interest and background in the kind of thing we're going to be talking about in this book. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here.
Nice to have you on. So the book is called We Were an Island, the subtitle, The Maine Life of Art and Nan Kellum. And so just to finish my introduction, these weren't hippies or homeless people or squatters. I mean, this was 1949, you know, well over half a century ago. And Art Kellum was an aerospace engineer from Cornell University. And his wife, Nan Kellum, had a degree in economics from the University of Wisconsin. You know, and we're not talking home economics. We're talking economics, which in the late 40s was very unusual for a woman to go to a major university and study and get a degree in. So they had moved to California, where he was employed in advanced research at Lockheed. And so, Peter, what possessed them to buy an island in Maine?
Well, from the moment of their marriage, they had envisioned a place where they could both go and live a wonderful, deep life and a life full of love and interest, but without the maddening influences and all the pressures of modern society. And so this was something that was planned before the war, and at the end of the war in 1945, there was a green light for Art and Nan to go ahead and start to research and really look for island property. As a little bit of background, I should say that Art worked for Lockheed in designing fighter jet hydraulic systems and cooling systems, and so he really was part of the war effort. He was not part of the Manhattan Project, which is a myth which has persisted strongly up in Maine, that this guy was so horrified by the atomic blast over Japan that he retreated to a Maine island. That is a myth, but he was part of the war effort.
Tell us about the island they eventually bought.
550 acres. Of course, there are 3,000 islands on the coast of Maine that are above the water at high tide. That's the definition of an island. If you're underwater, you're a shoal. This is a magnificent landscape, which actually has certain resemblance to a ship or an old sailing vessel. It's very long as opposed to wide. I think we estimated about 4 miles shoreline. And from the water, actually looks like this large boat sort of heading out to sea. And this whole image comes up again and again in their writings, that in fact it is like a great big ship of which they're holding on to the tiller. In fact, the name Placentia comes from the French plaisance, and which actually doesn't mean pleasure. It means a boat that was designed for the free hours, the fun times, the pleasurable times. It's a pleasure yacht.
Yeah, okay. All right, so living in California, this is, you know, decades before the internet and so on. I mean, maps were available, but how did the Kellums find this island, and how did they settle on moving to Maine rather than the more obvious islands off the coast of California or Oregon or Washington State?
Right. They were first inspired by islands off the Washington State coast. They were looking in the West Coast. They also looked in the St. Lawrence River Valley area. And but Maine, I guess, was percolating in their thoughts. And what they did in California is really wonderful. They turned an entire living room wall into a mosaic of individual nautical charts. So you put one chart next to the other, and you've got the entire Maine coast. and they were able to kind of zero in on areas that were promising, finally coming down to 8 islands, which they actually visited in the company of a real estate agent and a lobsterman who got them out there.
Hmm.
Interestingly enough, on the wall in California, they would, some of these maps were very detailed, and they actually would show if there were buildings, and they said that automatically disqualified it if it had any sign of habitation. Ironically, they ended up on Placentia finding some wonderful old foundations and old buildings which they resurrected. But their impulse was to get away from crowds, get away from anybody, and just not to have to deal with a house that someone else has built.
Were they, I mean, I don't think from reading your book that they were misanthropic in that they hated people, but it seems like part of their motivation was to live apart, not as hermits exactly, but to be isolated and not to have to deal with crowds. But was there more to it? I mean, Art was an engineer. He was a technologist, but I think I have the impression from your book that they wanted to be free of technology and free of a lot of the modern conveniences that are also modern traps, you know?
Right, exactly. There, I think the term we came up with in the book is the not-so-hermits. They have tendencies to be alone. Obviously, you wouldn't pick an island surrounded by deep salt water if you wanted masses of human company. They wanted to have a bit of control over who came to see them. They eventually became friends with a number of folks, who lobstermen and other local folks, and also people on, you know, cruising the coast during the summer, they get to know them. There were two classes of people to the Kelhams, those they knew and were welcome to come up and say hello, and those that they didn't want. And it's so funny to read in the journals the exact description of these different types of folks. In my own case, I had a terrible mistake when I first met her. I dropped a whole container of strawberry ice cream basically on her doorstep and on her. And I had the amazing experience of reading the journal entry for that day, which said, I want to make sure, Nan says this, that Hilton Holmes, the lobsterman, sees this man off the island. She was mad. And so eventually we became great friends. But anyway, I was a stranger when it started at the door of her privacy, and it was not really appreciated. But once you get to be a friend of hers, it's a different story. A lot of different theories about the Kelhams and why they did what they did. The most prevalent is the nuclear situation, the Manhattan Project. If you ask anybody in Maine who hasn't read the book, just, oh, that funny couple out there, he designed the atom bomb.
Mm.
We know that's not true. Other stories were that he was a German spy left off by a U-boat, Russian spy during the Cold War. He had some terrible physical injury that he was hiding from the world. And then they followed that up with another theory. This is all these theories trying to make sense of something that was just hard to pinpoint for people looking at them from the outside, that they had some terrible psychological thing that had happened, maybe a breakdown of some sort. And all of these were so far from the truth. And that's what's so wonderful about the journals. We can actually plot the progression following a dream, as you said, from the earliest moments of their wedding to the green light at the end of World War II to actually taking the steps to make it happen.
Obviously, when there's a shortage of information or something's mysterious, people make up quasi-information to fill the gaps, and that's clearly what was happening. So you mentioned her journal. I think she was a prolific writer, at least in her journal. And was Art also a writer? I mean, was that part of their motivation for moving there,
yeah,
that they wanted to write?
Absolutely. They wanted the piece to write. And Art was writing fiction, short stories primarily. And Nan focused on the journals, which were really a day-by-day description of what was going on and in full detail. But not necessarily in a form that would be readable. It's just really the bare facts. At the same time, both of them together were working on what they call the Big Book, which would be a far more eloquent, beautiful description of their early days out on the island. And they only got through about 4.5 chapters of that before that project was abandoned. You see a number of times that they spoke to folks in magazines were interested in them, but they never got their story out in the way they would have liked, and I think they're getting a real kick now, wherever they are.
Hmm.
That finally is is finally coming out. And actually, there was an earlier book called Alone Together, which is really a photographic essay of the island. And David Grimm, who was a photographer that worked with me on We Were an Island, did some wonderful photographs for that. And that was just sort of a teaser, getting folks to think about the real puzzle and wonderful life, and then we were able to follow through with the actual journals. So they wanted to be writers. They also had a special building in addition to their house called Homewood, which was an old barn refurbished. They built a six-sided house on the shoreline where they could go alone from each other to write. And that's kind of interesting that they needed the space and recognized the need for space, even as a couple on an island. And they would also share the bandstand, but it was a retreat on each other.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Peter Blanchard III about his book, We Were an Island, The Maine Life of Art and Nan Kellum, and Maine Life is the State of Maine. We're talking about two people who, back starting in the late 40s, lived a very reclusive life on a large island off the coast of Maine that they owned and built a house on and lived for about 40 years there on that island. So, Peter, how did they live? Were they totally isolated from the main coastline and the world around them? And then
Nope. You
mentioned their house, so tell us how they built the house and what it was like.
Right. Well, just to go back to the first part of your question, there was a lifeline that continually kept them in contact with the Mount Desert Island, which was 2 miles away from them, open water. They had a dory, a wooden dory, which they rowed to and from, 4 mile round trip, Mount Desert Island, for supplies, for mail, and basically errands that they had to do. So it wasn't the complete isolation that one would think. They, in fact, had and depended on that dory. At times, they were given a lift from lobstermen who would see them rowing along. One amazing point is that a number of lobstermen volunteered to give them an engine so they wouldn't have to row all that distance, and they declined.
Hmm.
They preferred to be in charge of their vessel. The house that they eventually worked up, actually quite quickly, landing on June 8, 1949, was an old barn, and we have pictures of it in the book in 1910 when it was just surrounded by fields and old stone walls. Of course, the island has grown up a lot since then, but they've demolished parts of the structure and rebuilt it so that even by that first winter of 49-50, they already had a good place to sequester in. So that building was really the center point of their life on the island.
Was that the building you called, or they called Homewood?
Yes, right.
Okay. I've seen pictures of it, and in Peter's book, by the way, which is a very well-produced book, it's expensively done, it's lots of photographs, and you can tell by the it's not an extremely long book. What do we got here?
212.
212, thank you, pages. But but it weighs a lot. You can tell the quality of a book often by how heavy it is relative to its size, because the paper is good quality and everything. So there are interesting photographs of the house, and you can see that these people built it themselves pretty much by hand, and you can see it's very well built with lots of, nice custom fittings, and they built it to meet their needs in detail, right?
So
it stood a long time. I guess you said at the beginning that it burned down or was burned down not too long ago.
It was demolished by the owner of the island, and we should clarify this. They donated the whole island to the Nature Conservancy. Upon their death, they had life estates. So that was understood that both of them or one of them alone would be out there. But when they both passed away, it would go to a national conservation organization. And that's how I met them. I was representing the Nature Conservancy when I first opened the door and spilled the ice cream on the poor lady.
Mm-hmm.
So the island is owned by that group, and the Conservancy really typically does not save buildings. They're into the open space and the land around. And so rather than have a liability, which this building was becoming, they had it knocked down and then burned. And so all is left is really the foundation of the building, which includes some of the 19th century predecessor building, and the footprints that they left in 1950. They left his footprint and hers side by side in wet cement as a symbol of this incredible journey they were taking. I like to think at the moment they did make those prints, they were kicking free from all the pressures and constraints and difficulties and expectations and technological advances of a world that had just sort of become too much.
It kind of reminds you of Robinson Crusoe's footprints on the sand, I guess. But what did they do for money? I mean, you said they did buy things. They bought food and materials and building supplies and so on.
A little bit of a mystery, although we know he had a good salary from Lockheed. We know that there was some parental help from both the parents who actually came out. His parents came out to the island to visit at one point. There was probably an investment set up and banking accounts, but they were never well off in any sense. And that sort of rides against the view that anybody buying an island, oh my gosh, they must be millionaires. But in fact, that wasn't true. They sold their home in California in the Canyon Lands near Los Angeles for just about the price that they purchased Placentia Island, about $10,000. And that was a huge expense, of course. And throughout the journals and their life, the theme of frugality comes forward, that you have to make the best with what you have, to be very inventive, and a lot of that is cost-driven. They just couldn't afford to have all kinds of lavish equipment. The only area they did sort of break down in, and they were not purists, they had a generator which operated a sawmill, and the generator was only on during the sawmill operation.
I'll be darned, no lights or anything, huh?
No, they had kerosene lights.
Lantern. Yeah, but no radio and so on. Well, in general, give us a flavor, Peter, of what day-to-day life was like for them. Obviously, it varied during the seasons, but what did they spend most of their time doing?
Well, I think the main concern was always wood for their oven. They had an oven and a pot-bellied stove, so that for cooking and for heating purposes, it was important to have wood. And early on, it's really amusing to hear that they just sort of took an axe or two and went out and thought, we'll just see a few dead trees around in the neighborhood of the building, and that'll see us for quite a while. Well, they had a rude awakening. that was in the fall, and the conditions were getting pretty cold, and they discovered that they needed a lot more wood than that. So they began to range widely over the island and to harvest dead wood primarily and chop it into certain lengths that were easily hauled, and then basically have it out on the porch there on various stages of drying. So that was a main endeavor. They explored and were constantly walking over the island and kind of basically being the stewards of it. They took on very seriously that this is a place on Earth that we're lucky enough to inhabit and we've got to take care of it. Well, they were concerned about folks who were coming on with campfires above the high tide line. And they were particularly concerned with hunters. They took on a personal role of protecting the island's deer. So they were continually, during the hunting season and sometimes outside of it, they were confronting these folks who were landing, and generally armed and generally intent on obtaining a deer. And all of a sudden, here's this diminutive little lady and her very taciturn husband standing there saying, I know your family may have done this for generations or whatever, but we own the island now, and I'm sorry, it's not allowed. So it's pretty gutsy. The reading I mentioned, basically designing all different aspects of their life. I mean, they had to develop and build a septic system. They had to rebuild walls. I mean, they were constantly busy, projects after project after project, that all comes out in the journals. Designing a way to have hot water for a shower, which involved metal containers in full sun. I mean, really amazing things that they were working on. I mean, survival is a concept that was part of their picture. It was not a free, lovely vacation or just time away from everything. They were working hard just to make their life livable out there.
Well, frontier life was never easy, and essentially they were living something very close to frontier life, and they had to discover for themselves that it's a full-time job and a lot of hard work and very uncomfortable a lot of times. I'm sure they had a big garden, too, huh?
They had, right. They did raise some vegetables, but never, enough to really take care of the whole situation. They would depend on their rows to the mainland or Mount Desert for groceries. But, they had several gardens going at the same time, and wonderful devices to keep their friends, the deer, from devouring the garden.
So they didn't hunt, but did they eat meat?
They ate meat that was from the grocery.
Sure.
They did not hunt. No. And interestingly enough, being on an island, surrounded by salt water. They really weren't into fishing or, you know, harvesting shellfish or that sort of thing. What would happen from time to time is a lobsterman friend of theirs would, or a fisherman friend would come by and leave some fish for them, signal with his horn, and they would come down. So this is not what we call self-reliance. This is something else, and I think part of the beauty of the story is that they really are kind of like everyday folks and trying to make do in an unusual situation, but without being, let's say, a Thoreau or someone living intently, surviving on their own, counting those rows of beans, as Thoreau did.
Right.
However, Thoreau was there for a year, I think, and the Kellams were out there for almost 40 years. So anyway.
It was an experiment for him, but it was a total lifestyle for them. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Peter Blanchard about his book, We Were an Island, describing the life of a married couple off the coast of Maine from the late 40s into the kind of mid to late 80s, or mid-80s anyway. Peter, what was their relationship like? I mean, here's a married couple who aren't, you know, one of them isn't going off to work for 8 hours or 10 hours a day. They're together pretty much all the time in a very isolated spot. Was their relationship so close that they always got along? Tell us about that.
Yeah, at one level, probably the most vital level, they were very much in love with each other, and their continual correspondences between them, they developed their own language, which with words that had special coding in them that they communicated that way. They were always giving each other presents and watching for the special holidays and birthdays and occasions.
Mm-hmm.
The journals are full of those tiny but important acts of chivalry that continually go along.
Sure.
One includes Nan serving Art his breakfast in bed, which became quite a routine for them. And then as a special favor, it would reverse and he would serve her.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that incredible closeness and recognition that this is a joint venture that they're doing, and it's a labor of love. But as in all things, reality has there's negative aspects to it too. There were tensions that built up, and particularly difficult for Nan was the tremendous prowess that she saw in her husband, that he was capable of doing so many things well. He was an inventor, and he was good at carpentry, and he was stronger, and so all these things build up, and you can see in the journals that she's getting to kind of resent that, and there are the dark moments that occur, and this is not pure bliss, this is life.
Mm-hmm.
All relationships have their ups and downs, and so it's kind of interesting to see that. In terms of the actual physical side of love, you never hear much about that in the journals. What you hear is that she moved a sleeping bag a few feet closer to his, that kind of thing. We're talking about the 1940s and 50s, and folks didn't really go into any detail about their lives.
Sure.
And so in that respect.
Their sex lives anyway, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh.
But did, you know, I mean, again, it was the 40s and the 50s and the 60s when I think there was in general in society, there was a bigger difference in gender roles. So where they lived, Art and Nan together, was there a really distinct difference in their roles where he was the man and wore the pants and he was the master of the household and she was, you know, was it like that?
She was always felt that she was an apprentice to him in most endeavors, and that word comes up again and again.
Hmm.
And that, you know, that he is so good at everything, and how can I ever achieve that? But he was very good about bringing her along, encouraging her, and letting her shine. There's that funny element, despite all the love and the tremendous experience together, there was friction.
Were there any really? I don't remember reading in your book, and I read much of it, but not all of it, and I flipped through all of it that I didn't really read, but I didn't see anything about anything bad ever happening. I mean, nobody ever broke a leg, you know, no bear ever attacked them. Were there any really unusual experiences that they had? Maybe describe one, just either extremely good or extremely bad, huh?
Well, she fell and knocked her head and was bleeding profusely. This was several years before he died, and they put into effect their warning system, which was a red flag they raised from a spruce tree that was now just a pole, by the water, and Lobsterman saw that and they got a doctor to actually come out and treat her. So they were being reminded, actually, from time to time of their vulnerability and the fact that this was not going to last forever, that the health of one or both would fail, perhaps. And, in fact, that's what happened with Art. He got very sick suddenly. She tried to signal, and only a day and a half or so later was that signal picked up. And the ferry boat actually came over and helped him, and but Art passed away within hours of being picked up.
I would say that was lucky, in fact, that they went for 40 years with nothing really catastrophic happening, and that he died so quickly. That was pretty much ideal if you have to go. Yeah, right. Well, during that long stretch of four decades, did they ever waver in their commitment to this lifestyle they'd chosen? Did they ever get to a point where they're thinking, what the hell have we done?
Yes. There were those times ashore, whether it was due to a storm that kept them from coming back to the island or whether they were actually taking a trip. They were not always on the island every moment. They would take a trip from time to time. And Art would purposely test her by going to a motel and flipping on a light switch and turning on the heat radiator and just saying, hey, do you miss this? And the invariable answer was, no, let's get back to Placentia.
Let's get out of here quick before I do.
Yeah, right. And then he was offered a job, a teaching job, actually, at Cornell, and declined. They were both talking about, gee, should we do it? It's a wonderful opportunity. And then, but they both, no.
Well, Peter, we just have a minute or so left. How did they end? You mentioned that Art died pretty suddenly. What year was that, and what did Nan do after that?
1985, he passed away, and she lived out there by herself for a couple of years before retiring to a senior home, and that was an incredibly difficult time for her. But also, she made up for his physical loss by having an idea of him still being there in spirit. And that's a whole aspect of the last days on the island that comes out in the journals. That just because a partner has passed away, they needn't be that far away.
As we said at the beginning, it was kind of reminiscent of Thoreau living in Walden Pond. But as you pointed out, he did that as kind of an experiment for a year. But he was a transcendentalist. Is it too highfalutin to say that the Kellams, did they transcend modern society and find a higher spiritual life?
No, that was that would be a stretch.
Okay.
Basically, they were seeking a wonderful life together, but was without a specific philosophy or transcendent ideal.
Okay.
You don't hear much religious thought coming through in the journals or religious reference. And I would say that the wonderful part about them, in a way, is that they are every man. They're not. They don't stand out as some purist endeavor, but they basically were folks, just everyday folks.
All right, just kind of ahead of their time in terms of people wanting to escape society, maybe. Well, the book is We Were an Island, The Maine Life of Art and Nan Kellam. The author is Peter Blanchard. It's published by the University Press of New England. Website is www.upne, universitypressofnewengland.com. And the book is also available through Amazon and other booksellers. Peter, thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety. It's been fascinating.
Thank you so much, too. That was great.
And thanks to you all for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place for more American Variety Radio.